Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon. Orion was talking about how some of the tech stocks are leading the way lower, Amazon among them. We will talk about Amazon coming up a little bit later this half hour. They're dropping a lot of money on lobbying these days. And from the Washington Post, we will talk to reporter Andrea Johnson about that, about why they're doing that, what it is that is, Andrea Peterson, I should say, about what it is that's drawing Amazon to Washington and spending the money. First, though, Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business is in the studio. Frank, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
You've recovered from your Super Bowl festivities and the wild parties and all of that stuff.
Yeah, sitting at home with my kids having a Diet Coke. I'm really hungover.
That's pretty much the way I was, although I didn't even have the Diet Coke. I think I had a cup of coffee. So
I was on Twitter with all my friends,
though. Were you?
Yeah.
And were they having as much fun?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody was unanimous that the ads were more disappointing than they should have been in the game as well.
Yeah, I think that's the way we feel every Monday after the Super Bowl, feels like. All right, let's go into it. Last week we were talking about the O'Hare expansion, the agreement to build a new runway, and everyone said, well, we've got the gates. Well, the gates shoe dropped over the past week. I know they're still negotiating it, but it's the small airlines now who are kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, don't forget us.
Right. It's a big dance the city is doing because United and American control currently 89% of the gate real estate, and they would like more, and they're actually the airlines that are paying for most of this expansion. Meanwhile, smaller airlines and consumers who want competition would like to see those gates opened up to some other players. And so now we're hearing that there could be 14 additional gates as part of this plan ultimately. And Virgin America would like to have some of those. JetBlue, Spirit, Frontier Airlines, they would all like to have some. But of course, the incumbent dominant airlines would also like to have those gates at O'Hare. So the city is definitely going to have to arbitrate that.
And United and American, they're saying, wait a minute, we're paying for this dance. Why would you let Virgin come in and compete with us with extra gate space?
Yeah, that's right. And United currently has 83 gates and American has 66. So they are by far the dominant gates. And a lot of the other ones just have part of one gate. You know, they have a shared gate that they have some priority on in the case of Virgin America. And, but in the meantime, they're increasing their flights. So they do have a lot of pressure on trying to add a gate or two.
And so better for the consumer, I would imagine, if this is spread out a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So if a Spirit or a Frontier, some of these low-cost airlines were to get more gates, they would, at least on the routes that they serve, they would put pricing pressure on the major incumbent airlines.
Let's talk real estate, too. Dennis Rodkin's in here from time to time, and we follow the real estate market. He's got a story in Cranes about how, our home prices here have been pretty stagnant. They're not rising at the level across the country as they are across the country. But it looks like what they're calling distressed properties are doing very well. Now, distressed properties, those are homes owned by the banks, right, in foreclosure?
That's right, foreclosure homes. And so we are seeing it's indicative of finally ironing out the overhang of foreclosed homes from the financial crisis. You are seeing the prices of the foreclosures finally kind of really spiking. They rose 6.3% last year in median price, according to Midwest real estate data. That's 16 times better than the median 0.4% price increase of conventional homes in this area. So we are seeing they are leading the pack. And it's really important at a time when in November, where the most recent month data is available, Chicago area home prices increased just 2% from a year earlier. And they are lagging. Chicago is the 20th of 20 major markets ranked by S&P Case-Shiller for the third consecutive month. Meanwhile, markets like San Francisco, Denver, and Portland, Oregon go up 11% year over year. So we're really stagnant. But the one bright spot is that these foreclosures are really on the rise.
All right. So why are they on the rise? Is it, people trying to flip homes, or what's increasing these prices?
Yeah, there's more competition as more investors and homeowners feel confident to bottom fish for deals because they're seeing the data on the sales prices and post-rehab set resale. So they know that there's going to be a decent return on the investment. And then banks have gotten better at dressing these homes up, really doing some rehab so that they can get higher prices at auction. And then the other thing is the number of foreclosures on the market is falling. It's falling to 21% of homes sold in Metro Chicago in 2015, and that's a low since the bubble burst in 2007-2008. It was at 40% in 2011 and 2012, so it's a half of the stock that it was back during the teeth of the financial crisis.
We've got just a minute left, but you know what's old is new again. I guess when I was growing up at the Mantino Sportsman's Club, people would go out with their shotguns and they would shoot skeet. There are actually a couple clubs where in my hometown, and I remember there was one along the lakefront here at Diversey, but there's an article in Crane, Shia Kapos writes about the fact that skeet shooting is becoming more and more popular at golf clubs during the winter when people can't golf, and it's become sort of a business meeting venue.
Exactly. So local executives take 30 minutes out of their day as compared to what it would take for 18 holes of golf. They go to places like Medina Country Club, Westmoreland Country Club, Sunset Ridge in Northfield, or Evanston Golf Club in Skokie, and they shoot some skeet. They say pull, and the clay pigeon goes up, and they shoot it. Shia really had a good time going out, actually seeing these guys shooting. You can see her column at ChicagoBusiness.com. It's something that I wasn't aware was a big thing around here.
I didn't know it was either, and I like that some of the guys who do it say, well, it's really a mental game. You know, we're out here. We need to think. It's like golf. We need to focus. We're exercising our brains.
It's an Olympic sport, they
say. It's an Olympic sport. That's right. More of this and other stories, ChicagoBusiness.com.
That's right. Thank
Frank Sennett, thanks for coming in. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, you might be spending money with Amazon. Amazon has been spending money in Washington, D.C. Andrea Peterson is a writer for the Washington Post, and she's got a story about that today in the newspaper. Andrea, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so tell me about this. Amazon is really increasing the amount of money they're spending when it comes to lobbying. What's that about?
So, yeah, Amazon has nearly doubled their lobbying in 2015 versus the previous year. They were up to $9.4 million, which puts them in the same sort of space as Facebook and Microsoft. And what's really going on is that Amazon, even though we think of it as an online retailer, has very much sort of diversified their business. And they now actually have a lot of different interests in Washington as well. I mean, one of the big ones is Amazon Web Services, which is something you or I might not necessarily think about, but is a cloud computing service offered by Amazon. They help keep up sites like Netflix and Airbnb, and increasingly the federal government. They have a lot of different contracts there, and we know from their lobbying disclosures that at least some chunk of the money that they're spending here in the nation's capital is going to lobbying on government procurement for IT and cloud solution services.
And who knew that they are getting big money when it comes to government contracts? I mean, I see in your story that they've got, a $600 million deal with the CIA?
Yeah, so back in 2013 is really when they inked that one. It was actually contested by IBM, which had bid on the same contract, and it's worth up to $600 million, essentially to create government cloud specifically for the intelligence community. So there really are a lot of connections in Washington that perhaps your average shopper may not necessarily realize. I mean, another connection to Washington, is, and I like to make sure I get this early on in interviews, is that Jeff Bezos, the CEO and founder of Amazon, is also the owner of the Washington Post, the paper that I write for. In fact, one of the reasons I was able to ask him about some of his lobbying interests was because he came to the office to do a town hall with employees. And I always try and take advantage of that to get in a few reporting questions.
It's always tricky when you're quoting the boss, though, isn't it?
You know, it's certainly an interesting situation, although Mr. Bezos has made it very clear that there's a separation between Amazon and the Washington Post, which is a personal holding of his.
All right, I want to talk about, so the cloud thing is interesting to me, and you write also that the SEC has sort of put Amazon on a bit of a notice that they might be flirting with trouble. I'm not sure I understand that. Can you explain that for me?
So it's not so much of the SEC has put them on notice, but within their latest SEC filings, which, you know, public companies have to do on a quarterly and an annual basis, that Amazon itself identified that they're increasing business relationships with the government and comes with added risks because those contracts could be investigated, they could shift, and that they're subject to potential audits and investigations to how well they perform underneath those contracts.
All right, let's talk let's talk drones in the minute we have left. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Andrew.
Yeah.
But, so because Bezos said, and I'm assuming it was in this Washington Post employee roundtable that he had, or the town hall meeting, but talking about, you know, they're obviously lobbying when it comes to sales taxes, which is a whole other topic, but then drones as well. And he says that, you know, Amazon wants to use drones to deliver packages. That will probably happen overseas or in Canada before it happens here.
Yeah, so one of the other issues that Amazon has really been lobbying on over the past few years is that they have this vision for delivering packages via drones. But the way that they want to do that, which would be automated, doesn't really fit within the proposed regulation for commercial drone use that the Federal Aviation Administration is working on. And one of the things that Mr. Bezos said to me and to everybody else in that town hall was that there are other jurisdictions that he thinks are, quote, more forward-looking on these issues. And so it's likely that we're going to see that kind of innovation come to other places first.
Andrea Peterson from The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Innovation zones are the hot new thing in this country. Put great minds together at a Starbucks, maybe a Chipotle, where they can run into each other, and innovation can't help but ensue. Or maybe not. Eric Weiner has spent some time studying the geography of genius. In fact, it's the title of his latest book, and he joins us now. Eric, welcome to The Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be here.
How about that idea? Can you create an innovation district?
I don't think you can engineer it. Let's put it that way. I mean, if there was a formula, and if I knew it, I'd be a very wealthy man. Probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I'd be on my yacht in the Mediterranean somewhere.
I can be interesting even if you're wealthy.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you can engineer it because look at the track record. Look at how many places have tried to replicate Silicon Valley. There's Silicon Wadi and Thames Valley in England and all these efforts. They've all failed. Because ultimately, these places are cultures, and you can't really just engineer a culture. What you can do, though, is nurture a culture of innovation.
So you looked at seven different spots
right.
in different times in history, Athens, Vienna, Edinburgh, Florence, Silicon Valley, among them.
Yeah, and some more unusual places like Hangzhou, China, and Calcutta, right?
Calcutta was a surprise.
Yeah, it was supposed to be. I'm glad it was, but it was a place of genius for a while.
Are there commonalities there?
Yeah, I would say they all come down to three essential ingredients plus some extras. And the essentials are what I call the three Ds: diversity, discernment, and disorder. Diversity of ideas. I'm less interested in ethnic diversity, and I think what's more important is intellectual diversity. They often go hand in hand, but not always. And the second is discernment, which is often overlooked when we talk about creative places. We think, well, let's just be tolerant, open to everything. Las Vegas is a pretty open, tolerant place, but not a lot of geniuses coming out of there. So you need to be able to separate the good ideas from the bad ones. These places are not only magnets for talent, they're also colanders that separate. And the third ingredient is disorder, actually a degree of tension, of disruption. Even chaos in some places is essential.
Paradise is antithetical to creativity.
I've read that somewhere. That's absolutely true.
Those were your words.
Yeah, and if there were a paradise out there, it would probably be the least creative place in the world because there would be nothing that you need to create. There would be nothing to push against. And, Steve, one of the conclusions I reach is that creativity always, always requires that we have something to push against, some challenge we have to respond to.
Challenge as in competitiveness or just tension among creators?
I would say it's almost like the place creates a challenge which people collectively respond to, but there's always competition within that collective. You know, I'm thinking of, well, Athens. You know, we think of it as this golden age, and it was, but it wasn't an easy place. The land, rather, was barren. And it was not the biggest and the baddest of these Greek city-states. Florence had been decimated by the plague and was really nothing special when all of a sudden the Renaissance blossomed. So I look around at some firms today in Silicon Valley that are giving their companies everything they need. Rather, they're giving their employees everything they need, you know, to be creative, from beanbag chairs to ping pong tables. And I worry that they're forgetting that important ingredient of constraints.
I want to go to Vienna. You talked about there maybe were two eras in Vienna, the musical era in the beginning and then Freud 100 years later. But let's talk music, because you mentioned diversity as well. There's a lot of talk about immigrants here and immigration.
Right.
Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, the great musicians of Vienna in that period weren't from Vienna. They weren't altogether immigrants from another country, but they were put into somewhere a bit unknown to them and uncomfortable, and they brought that to that area.
Right, and that's often the case. And there's a long list of refugees and immigrants who have become geniuses: Einstein, Marie Curie, Sigmund Freud, and the musicians that you mentioned. And I don't think this is a coincidence. And I don't think it's just a matter of hard work. That's the conventional narrative about the immigrant success. They're hungry, they're motivated, they work hard. That's part of it. But they also bring this sort of what's been called an oblique perspective. They see things differently, right? You know, if you're from someplace else, you have different ways and different attitudes. And what's really interesting, Steve, is it's not just that you, the immigrant, benefit from this oblique perspective. Everybody does, because creativity is contagious. And once someone comes into a city with some new idea about whatever, it could be someone who uses chopsticks instead of a knife and fork, and people thought, wow, it never occurred to us. Now, those people may still use the knife and fork because they're used to it, but their mind has been opened up to what I call the possibility of possibility.
Also in Vienna, there was the coffee house.
Yes.
And you write about what you call the third place. And maybe I touched upon that in the introduction. You know, here in Chicago, the Innovation District, really, they've got the Google headquarters, things like that. And then the idea is there are going to be hip restaurants outside. The third place where people are going
to
run into.
They don't have to be hip. They don't have to be hip.
Okay.
In fact, I would argue that they should be a little run down.
But is that what the Vienna Coffee House is?
Yeah.
Is that the same thing?
These were places that were not first and second places, not work and not home, but sort of sanctuaries, safe territory where you could go for a minimal entrance fee, the price of a cup of coffee, and get the news of the day. But I think the key point is a couple things. One is that the conversation is always freewheeling, and among people who normally maybe wouldn't hang out together, you'll find them in a third place. And the second thing is actually, believe it or not, the sound. The ambient sound of a coffee house at about 70 decibels, research shows, is actually the ideal acoustic level for creative thinking.
Why do you think that is?
I think because it defocuses your attention. You know, if you sit in a quiet room and try to be creative, you're aware of your own thoughts. That may be good for, you know, doing your tax returns or something that requires really intense concentration. But when we're creative, we're not actually concentrating. We're diffusing our attention, widening it. If you have a little distraction, a little background noise, it makes it easier to do so.
You point out that the genius wouldn't necessarily be a PhD. A genius has a more widespread sort of area of knowledge.
If you have a PhD, you're statistically less likely to become a genius than someone without a PhD.
Because you're too focused on one area?
Because you're too specialized, I think, and especially true today. Because genius really, the genius is not a know-it-all. They're a see-it-all. They're able to see connections between different points of light that other people haven't made. And in order to see those connections, you have to get out of your own field, at least for a while.
I desperately want my children to be successful and to be geniuses, and I'm afraid I might have to die to make that happen.
It is what Sartre said, that the best gift a father can give to his son is to die young, but it's too late for you.
It's too late, it is, I know.
It's too late, but it is true statistically. Lots of geniuses have lost a parent at a young age, usually a father, or suffered some other trauma, right?
So we talked. So that speaks to the paradise and the chaos.
Yeah, exactly. It's that sort of hardship that we talked about on a communal level, but on a personal level. And some people, not all, but some respond to that kind of challenge with amazing creativity.
All right, let's go to Silicon Valley then. Like Athens, not a lot is created in Silicon Valley. They bring in ideas and sort of they use their discernment.
And they discern between this is an idea worth running with, this is a bad idea. And for the ones that are considered good ideas, there is a system, you know, an informal but a very efficient system for fast-tracking those ideas. So you're right. Not a lot was actually invented in Silicon Valley. It's not where ideas are born, but it's where they come of age, where they learn to walk and to run.
One other thing, then, Florence in the Renaissance was known for its patrons, the Medicis. And you argue, perhaps, that there are patrons in Silicon Valley.
Right. They're not the Medicis. They're the venture capitalists.
They're the ones Bernie Sanders would say are contributing to Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Perhaps they are, yeah. Among other people.
Yeah.
But what they're contributing to Silicon Valley is that discernment function, right? You know, it's not enough to have a good idea. You need to convince other people to believe in your idea. You need other people to back your idea. That's as important. I would argue it's actually more important than the genius.
Can you then be swept up in an area of genius, or do you have to arrive there?
What do you mean?
I don't know. It just kind of struck me, you know, I mean, because I'm talking about, and I think of Silicon Valley as somewhere where no one is really from. I think of people traveling there to succeed.
That's
the musicians
true.
Going to Vienna to succeed, not intentionally, but they did. So I just wonder if this genius has to be on a bit of a pilgrimage to get there.
It helps because of that oblique perspective, because they're seeing things differently, and because, you know, there is something actually about motion, movement, that I think makes us more creative. Charles Dickens was a huge walker, as many geniuses were. He walked through the streets of London in the middle of the night when he had writer's block. Many geniuses had some of their best ideas occur to them in the back of a carriage, like Charles Darwin and Mozart, or on a train, as one great physicist did. So there's something about picking up and moving that helps us think better.
Jerick Weiner, the name of the book is The Geography of Genius. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I didn't realize until, I guess it was just this year, that there's sort of a post-Super Bowl season for selling your homes. People who take their homes off the market over the holidays, they wait until things sort of settle down, and by the calendar, that sort of ends up being the Super Bowl. So once the Super Bowl is passed, people start to put more and more homes on the market, and people start to look for homes, too. We're joined in the studio by Brian Balduff. He is the CEO of VHT Studios. Brian, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hello, Steve. Thank you.
And so the idea of just having an open house or being in the MLS listing and all of that, that's nice. But here we are in the digital age. People need to do a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the Super Bowl. It's kind of the traditional start of the real estate season because back in the day, football fans didn't really want to go to open houses on Sundays, nor did they want to have people coming through their houses on Sundays.
Right.
So once the Super Bowl was over, you know.
I see, because people wanted to be home watching the game all through the fall, right?
We didn't want to.
Okay, so VHT, what do you guys do?
Well, so if you've ever seen, if you've ever been looking for a house or an apartment or a place to stay or even a business, a restaurant or a hotel, and you've seen some gorgeous, stunning photographs, chances are that's VHT Studios.
Really? Chances are?
Oh, yeah. We have most of the top real estate and architectural photographers in the country call VHT Studios their home.
Right. And so what is the value of that? Because I would imagine, I mean, you know, my last home purchase was, I think, 18 or 19 years ago, when a realtor would have a website and it would be a still of the outside of the home, maybe two or three on the inside. It's completely changed since then, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the value of the professional photography, especially what we do at VHT Studios, it grabs people's attention because the internet's changed everything. You know, we mentioned the Super Bowl's the start of the season, but now with the internet, people can look 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at their convenience without ever disrupting the homeowner. So you have, you know, tons of interior photographs, 3D tours, you have videos. We're doing aerial photography now. And it just, there's so many homes on the market. You have to stand out. You have to grab people's attention.
I know that VHT is the standard and people should all go there. But I'm wondering if you can do it on your own, too. Can people do this on their own? Or do they try?
People try, but you see it less and less. Most professional realtors now use professional photographers just because you're competing with, you know, other products on the internet that have amazing, stunning visual presentations.
So who are your clients? Are your clients the for sale by owner people, or are they more realtors?
It's mostly professional realtors, top firms around the country, brokerage firms, builders, property management companies, and a lot of businesses, hotels, restaurants, anybody who's trying to attract attention, especially online.
I hadn't thought of that. You know, I do. We were just talking off the air. I lead trips and stuff. I take people around. And one of the things, one of my sales tools is the website of the hotels. Because we try to stay in nice hotels. So look at this website. And right, it's all the pictures of the rooms, the exterior and all of that. That's the work you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you've seen it. If there's not great, stunning photographs, people just skip right past it. They're never going to look at it. It's the same with the home. It's the most expensive thing people are ever going to buy or sell. If the photographs don't look striking and affect, move, and motivate you, you're just going to move on.
And it can be a wonderful room, but if it's not a wonderful room beautifully photographed, you've probably missed the moment because people are just going to click on the other ones.
Yeah, they'll just go on to the next property. You'll never even know.
I was reading, too, in some of your marketing information. I thought this was interesting that you're not just going to the realtors for sales, but you're going to realtors to sort of bring in other salesmen or saleswomen, right? You work with me, we're going to have an attractive office, and you're going to get a nice sales force coming in.
Well, sure. Having a professional photography program for a brokerage helps them recruit top agents who say, I want to work for a firm that really knows how to present properties and market properties.
We're talking to Brian Baldoff, who is the CEO of VHT Studios, takes the pictures and the videos that you see on websites for homes. All right. Have you ever been to one that you just can't fix?
You know, you could do a lot in the studio with digital editing. But yeah, there's a few, and you can see some on our site at VHT.com, some bad ones that can't
be fixed.
What
do you do?
In that case, I mean, you show it as it is, and you know, there's a buyer for every property.
That's right. Everyone's got to find their home, right?
That's right.
Brian, thanks for coming in today. It was nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Same here.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.